On this episode of Unmanned, we talked to Logan Bonney and how he left the unmanned world to start his own restaurant and brewery as an entrepreneur. Enjoy the show.
And welcome to Unmanned. This is your host, Chris Kelso, and with me today is special guest Logan Bonney, who is the co-owner of the restaurant and brewery Anything But Beer. Logan, now's your time to shine. So go ahead and introduce yourself. Kind of give us a little bit of a background, and how's it going?
How's it going? Thanks for having me. My name's Logan Bonney. My background is I was in the Air National Guard for about 8 years, working as a sensor operator. While I was in the Air Force, I was doing a whole bunch of education leading up to exiting in 2017. So I got a bachelor's in business administration while I was still in, finished my master's in entrepreneurship while I was in, and graduated with that master's in entrepreneurship from Syracuse University in, May of 2017, and separated in the same month, and then started the brewery in June of 2017.
Oh, wow.
obviously, it took some time to get all of our licensing together, because as a brewery, it's a heavily regulated industry. So it was almost 6 months before we were actually able to get a product out the door.
That's insane that you graduated, and then the same month you had separated.
Let the contract expire. It was somewhat of a, was it, they call it a quarter life crisis. I think a couple of years before that. So kind of thinking, is this what I want to do? Finished my 4-year degree. And once I finished the 4-year degree, the question was, do you become an officer, or do you separate? Because the next contract, once you're 8 years in, if you choose to be an officer, that's a minimum of an 8-year commitment. So mm-hmm. you might as well finish out 20, 30 years. I took the, what's it called? The AFOQT. So it's the officer test. And yep. I scored really high. I think all the options were there, but then the question was, is this what I want to do? I think in that little quarter life crisis, it's like, I want to start my own business, I want to be my own boss. I think mm-hmm. I think if we're allowed to talk about I was part of OEF and OFS. Is that too specific?
No, you're just talking about the conflicts that were going on while you were operational. So,
right.
That's fine.
Okay. So both those missions, remote control operations in Afghanistan, there was a lot of good aspects to the missions. I think that everybody's in the same boat with just the general global war on terror. It is a very complex and gray conflict. There's a lot there. And I think at the end of the day, it's very hard to see the benefits of your work. And a lot of those, what the long-term goals are kind of dictated to you. And then it's something that the global war on terror is something we'll be fighting for ever. I mean, that's
the never ending war.
I don't know how many years we're in on this, but it's
19 so far. So
yeah. Which I think there's good work to be done in it. But I think I wanted something that was more that something that I controlled, where I can step in, have control of what our end goals are, what we want to achieve, and then make a positive impact in the world in an area that I pick. And I think there's just a lot of power and self-determination and autonomy to starting your own business, which is why it was so appealing to me.
Now, my question is, I mean, you separated almost immediately after getting your degree. So I guess my question would be, how long were you thinking about starting your own business before that separation date came? I'm assuming this wasn't just on a whim. You were probably brainstorming. I mean, this is after your bachelor's degree, correct? Not your master's that you separated, or was it after the master's?
So it was after the master's I separated. Okay. I think prior to that, I was thinking about it. This isn't really my first business, as I started a property management rental company before that. Mm-hmm. So maybe at 21, 22, I took all the Air Force bonus money. So, I mean, if any military listeners, don't waste your bonus, don't buy a car.
Very smart. Very smart.
Cars disappear. So bought a house. And actually, I bought that house from a guy who was a light colonel on base. And he had used that house as a rental property. And he actually wanted to rent one of the rooms from me post selling the house to me. So it kind of worked out where I get all the tenants already in the house. I got all of the leases. And then I get this officer who has been doing this already, and I get 6 months of time while I sell the house to just say, all right, how's this work? Here's, I get all of his legal documents, like leases. There's other people on base who were also landlords at the time. And that was kind of my first introduction to owning what is essentially a small business.
Do you still have this property?
Yeah. So I, from I think 2011 until now, so I was buying houses as I was making money, and I think I got up to about 4 houses.
Wow.
Before I left the military. And then, let's see, in order to finance, so fast forward, start the brewery, and I just did that entirely organically, just try to spend as little as possible, invest as little as possible, and grow organically with your own revenues. But eventually we decided that we wanted to open a restaurant. In order to, so there's, I think, some myths about how to finance an entrepreneurial venture, in that they say, well, you're just going to go to a bank and you'll show them your projected income and they're going to give you money. And I think the disappointing truth of the matter is, banks do not partake in speculative lending. They just care about what money do you have and what money is coming in every month, and can you cover the loan with the money you have coming in? We did not get financing from a bank. So it was, how do we open this restaurant? Which, opening a restaurant costs a lot of money.
Yeah. And I'm assuming you didn't go the OPM route, did you?
What's OPM?
Other people's money, basically angel investors or things of that nature.
Oh, yeah. We did not. No, I ended up selling 2 of the houses. And what we found was, so in between all those things, instead of, there's angel investors, there's banks, but there's also local organizations that are interested in developing economics. So we found a local, essentially not-for-profit that works under the city of Syracuse in economic development, and they gave us a small amount of financing, something like, I don't want to say $20,000, and then just the rest of the project I financed by selling 2 houses.
Wow. So you still have 2 of them then, still pulling in, still working at.
Yep, it's a good business, and it's I think rental property is one of those things where if you have money, and I mean, you need the right team, like a good real estate agent, a good attorney, and a good mortgage broker. But if you can do the math right, so you know it's going to be a valuable investment, I mean, you can retire on rental properties. You just don't let them burn down, keep them maintained, and it's eventually you pay off your mortgage, and that's a retirement.
Yeah. Do you feel, well, actually, let me ask you this. Are you currently the property manager still, or have you outsourced that to a property management company?
I do it myself. I do a lot of student rentals. I rent rooms out of houses because that's more efficient. If you rent an entire house out, the actual amount of money you take in is less than if you were to rent the individual rooms out. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten pretty good at it. So only once a year or twice a year, I have to just make a rush, fill all the rooms, and then that's, at that point, passive income unless something breaks.
Yeah, because those students are locked in while they're in college.
Right, right. Yeah. We had to work some weird deals this year because of the COVID-19 crisis, but people were saying, I want to do month-to-month leases because I'm worried that the college is going to close. It's like, well, part of leases is like, well, let's just negotiate to figure out how we cover both our risk. I want a one-year lease. You're worried. You want to be able to get out of your lease if the school closes. Like, all right, let's put in a rider on this document. If your college closes due to COVID-19, you are released from this lease. So just we'll make a bet and split the risk. And
yeah, I like that. That's insurance right there.
And their college stayed open, so it worked out.
That's nice. Do you feel that it's difficult to manage the properties while simultaneously managing a business, or are you able just to bounce between the two pretty seamlessly?
I mean, some weeks there's going to be some juggling. It's
you're just a very busy person.
Right. I think it definitely takes a lot of time. I mean, right now, because the entire economy suppressed from COVID-19, I get a little bit more time. But I mean, generally, I'm putting in 80 hours a week, which is the minimum it probably takes to run the businesses.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you would have been able to do this had you stayed in as a guardsman, knowing that you can go to maybe a DSG status and only do one weekend a year, a month or whatever?
Well, the tough thing about the remote control plane, like that entire thing with the National Guard. With unmanned aircraft, anything in flying, you have to keep up currencies. So instead of it being one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year, you actually have to put in like 4, 5, 6 days a month. And that starts to become intrusive on other things. I think it's possible I could have done both.
Just a lot of plates to balance at one time.
Right. And I think one of the things that is important in entrepreneurship, depending on what you do, for me, I'm a go all in. You can have contingency plans, but the more resources and time that you put into your contingency plans, you almost, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of like, well, just in case my business fails, I've set up plan B. So I've got to invest 6 days a month into this. So that's X number of hours I'm not putting into the business, X number of brain cells that I'm not putting to work trying to figure out the problems with the business. And you've got like 1 foot in, 1 foot out, which I think when you first start is a good idea to have a plan B. Like, I have the rental properties, so that's my plan B. If things go poorly, I can kind of compensate for it. Mm-hmm. With the other business. Yeah, but I think that you got to commit to your decisions if you want the best odds of them working out.
It sounds like your plan A is that there is no plan B.
Yeah, I think I guess I like to think of it as cornering myself. If you just close off all pathways besides your plan A, well, then now you've got no choice but to make that work. You know, nothing's failed until you kind of give up on it. And if there's no giving up, then we're just going to continue.
So you decided to take the security and the normalcy of the Air National Guard job, which most people, when they go to the Guard, they're there till retirement. I mean, they're there for 20, 30 years plus. You decided to take that. Deal. Yeah, no. You take that and you just throw it away and you say, all right, I'm done my master's now. I'm going to go start a brewery and I'm going to become an entrepreneur. And you had already dabbled with entrepreneurship with the rental stuff, but this is different. There's a lot of people that own rental properties that don't have that as the only thing they're doing. You know, they work the 9 to 5s and they're renting out their old house or something, but you decided I'm going to go all in on this. So when, you know, why beer?
Before we listen to how Logan started the brewery, let's take a quick commercial break.
You know, it's a, it, let's see. So for the, at Syracuse University for the Entrepreneurship Master's Program, one of the most important things that you can learn in entrepreneurship is how to do market research. A lot of people think that entrepreneurship is, I have an idea, someone go out into the world and monetize that idea. But the most successful entrepreneurs have just a complete consumer focus. It's not what I want, it's what people want to buy that they're not getting now. That's where the biggest opportunity is. What problems do people have which aren't being solved? And that, like, focus on the outside, focus on people is really what's most important. So with that being said, how it ended up with the alcohol industry was I was in the classes. Every single class was essentially a formulate a business idea, do the market research, figure out how to commercialize that idea or data that you found, that need that is unmet, and then make a business plan around it and present it and then get ripped apart by your professor and classmates.
Which is good. That's a Shark Tank, you know?
Exactly. Just it's like that. This is unrealistic. That's ridiculous. You know, I think you have to really do your research. So I want to start a business walking into my master's there. So I would like to have a team that is doing research on my idea. All right. How do I get people to do research on my idea? So people are forming teams. It's like, all right, my idea is I'm going to do something in the alcoholic beverage industry. I already know how to brew wine. So if you join my team, I will give you free beer and wine.
Oh man, what a selling point. Free alcohol?
Well, yep.
Class is sitting on your side of the classroom there.
Right. Yep. Get a bunch of people. Cool. I don't know if that was the A team because of their motivations, but we're picking this industry. And with that industry, you start doing long interviews. You ask, why are you drinking beer at this party? Why are you drinking beer? Do you like this? Oh, you don't like beer. Why are you drinking it then? And then you just eventually, after you've interviewed maybe 50 to 100 people, you'll like just look at that data and see, look for irregularities that repeat themselves. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people at these parties who are drinking beer but don't enjoy the beer. Okay. And so we break down that data, we find that 40% of people drink beer most often. But in that group, when you break it out, I think 20% of that 40% of people actually prefer drinking things that are not beer. And
very interesting.
Yeah. So breaking that out, that was just like one tidbit of there's something going on here there's an opportunity to create beer alternatives that people enjoy that are still socially acceptable at parties. Fast forward, we start getting into dietary restrictions. The next semester, I open a new business plan and we're just looking for more data. So eventually we find it's the really sizable market is people who can't drink beer but would like to drink beer, would like to enjoy the beer drinking experience with their friends.
Now, was that more of a, was that a social thing? Is that they wanted to drink beer just to kind of fit in and have that social experience, or do they want to drink beer because they like beer and they just want to, that's going to be their alcoholic beverage of choice, but they couldn't do it?
So that's I would say it's the social aspects. I mean, there's a concept in business for like when someone purchases your item, like what are they actually buying?
Mm-hmm.
They're buying it for like what it does for them, not for like what the product is or the features. So for alcoholic beverages, the people who were drinking beer at the party who did not enjoy beer, the reason they were doing that was because that was the socially acceptable thing to do. You drink beer. That's how you fit into the party. Mm-hmm. So they're drinking something that they don't enjoy because that's what everyone else is drinking. It's like,
it's the need to fit in.
Exactly. You want to partake in this socially gratifying experience. So that was kind of the looking at, well, who doesn't have access to this socially gratifying experience? You expand that out and see where are your larger numbers of people. And we found people who are gluten sensitive, hop allergies, different things like that, or just didn't like the taste of beer. And just some of them was also people who are vegan. A lot of beers actually aren't vegan, so they can't just pick up a Bud Light and drink it because they don't know necessarily what the ingredients are.
I did not know that. I did not know that vegans could not have beer or certain beers.
Well, it depends on the beer. So there's a process in wines and beers called fining, where you're adding matter that's positively or negatively charged into the beer, and then that is going to attach to floating matter and cause it to sink. So one of the most popular ones is isinglass, which is a fish bladder extract. What's another one? There's a couple. Oh, like historically, wines had been clarified with egg whites.
Okay.
not that any of that's left behind, but if somebody is very intensely vegan, they don't want to drink something that animal matter fell through.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. So anyway, like the summary of the whole thing is, so we see all these groups of people and we say, all right, can we make a product that services all these people? Doesn't taste like beer, is vegan, is gluten-free, is hop-free. So that's like a matter of looking into laws. So we look through all the laws, what can we legally classify as beer? What can we legally make? What licensure falls into that? And yeah, so we came up with recipes. I just took, actually in the past at 21, the people who run Renaissance festivals are called the Society for Creative Anachronism. They're actually a group of historians. And that group, when I was younger, I was part of that group and they taught me mead making and wine making.
Nice.
So I just took those skills and applied it to making a new product with the correct ingredients. We put it together and then it just was refining that over time.
Are you telling me that this entire business was because you went to the Renaissance Fair?
Pretty much. That was the start.
There you go, kids. I mean, you're product. You're like the upside down world, man, from Stranger Things. You guys were able to figure out how to take something that basically was the exact opposite of everything in the normal brewing world and then turn it into a brew.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, I think that if you start with the mentality of people and their needs and then flow, how do I fix that? As opposed to the other side of it, of like, what do I have or what do I want to do? Obviously the need you're pursuing should be in the realm of things that you want to do, but I think you get more creative solutions and the world like is so much bigger than just the contents of your brain. If you're looking outside yourself, there's just so much more material there to entrepreneur off of, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to look at things through a different magnifying glass.
Right. Yeah. And that's interview 100 people and you'll get a lot of insight into whatever the heck you're researching.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess when you started out, I remembered you had, you know, the little kegs for the beer fests, which were very enjoyable. You had, and then you guys started bottling. I remember buying a 6-pack off of your co-owner at the mall just randomly. She was hanging out. She was hanging out outside of like J. Crew or something. It was a random store, and I just saw her and I saw the beer, and I was like, "Oh yeah, I'll buy a 6-pack." I didn't even know you could do that in the mall, but you know, here we are. So you have taken it from just the brewery now into a full restaurant downtown. Was the plan always to include food and do a restaurant, or did you realize this after doing the beer and going, "There's a whole market here for food as well"?
Well, I think we saw when we got into the business and we started growing it, one of the issues we ran into is, and this is something we should have realized more in the initial research, was that any manufacturing is an economies of scale favored business model. So that meaning that the bigger you are, the more profit you can make. So I don't know if you know Mad FX Brewing in, I think they're in Utica. They make Utica Club.
Okay.
I spoke with the president of that company, and we're just talking business, and was telling me, you know, economies of scale is the big thing. You need to be in a more hyper premium category and try to sell as much as you can in your tap room. At this time, we did not have a tap room. We were focusing entirely on wholesale because the initial model for the business was, all right, there's all these needs. We're going to make this product and then sell it business to business so that we can help other bars and restaurants better serve niche consumer segments.
Right.
That was our whole value proposition.
So it was a B2B to start.
Exactly. And that was the most scalable side of the business. But in order to scale, you need to be profitable. And the bigger you are, the more profitable you are. Starting out at that initial point, that you end up this catch 22 of you're not big enough to make enough money to become big enough.
So you realized you needed to go B2C.
So B2C was where the highest profit margins were. This is at least what Fred Matt told me. I think it was a good idea. So we said we have to have some sort of more retail segment. Now, we were doing a ton of B2C through events. So you saw my business partner in the mall at some athletic clothing company. Mm-hmm. And we did, I think in 2019, we did like 250 different events that year.
Wow.
If you count farmers markets and just those little pop-ups, and that's fine. But if you really want to monetize that, those different pop-up events could also be directing people to a retail site where we can make retail level profit margins and then funnel that back into the wholesale side and finance more events. So it's just more profitability equals more growth opportunity.
Yeah.
So that was the point of the restaurant. Oh, and then, so for the restaurant, so really that was a matter of the space determines the business model in a sense. So we're looking for a space, and where you locate a retail location, that neighborhood and what their needs are, and that space and what is available there kind of determines like where you should go with that business model. And we found a space in downtown that had this large kitchen. It had the opportunity for it. So we spoke about it, and it's actually food was a logical extension of our existing value proposition, which is, all right, we make alcoholic beverages for people with dietary restrictions, niche consumer segments. Mm-hmm. But what about those dietary restrictions also exist in food? Is there an opportunity to serve the same market with food that serves niche dietary restrictions? And we got a ton of great response. And I think that the value proposition of we're going to be a restaurant where anyone can walk in the door and have food they can eat and beer they can drink. And we actually end up getting a almost an exclusive customer base of people that only we can service, which is really cool and has helped us a lot during the pandemic.
Oh, absolutely. which allows me to go into my next segment. You started this brewery and opened this restaurant. When exactly?
Oh, so it was 6 months of construction. So we started our lease in July of 2019. Started ripping this place apart. I thought that we were going to hire contractors, and then it turns out contractors don't show up. So it was just me and anybody I can get to show up and swing a hammer and then teach them how to use tools.
Fantastic. That's how I want to build things.
Yep. 6 months later, we've got a restaurant, build out the menu, train up the staff, and February 14th, Valentine's Day, we open. February 2020, and close 30 days later for COVID-19.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but I mean, it is the timing of this is unbelievable. I'm sure you're not the only person that tried to start a business or open 2 weeks before COVID hit, but when that happened, as an entrepreneur, as someone that left security behind and decided to go balls to the wall, you worked your ass off, you got everything set in stone, you're ready to go, you open the doors, and 2 weeks later you're told to shut down. How did that make you feel in that moment? What was going through your mind?
So the day that they shut down the state, we were actually, so everything was already changing. And I was about to walk into a meeting with my kitchen manager and my front of house manager. And it was their first month of operations. So it was just pure chaos to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then 10 minutes before the meeting, my assistant, she says, "Hey, did you hear that an hour ago Cuomo said the whole state's shutting down at midnight tonight?" Oh, everyone hold on. I have to have a meeting with my business partner before we have this meeting. Yeah. And it's like, all right, so what are we going to do? It's like, we're not a restaurant anymore. So what are we and what do we do? And that's, we didn't have to go set up. And it was just, well, I think we don't have a front of house anymore. So that's it. We had to let go 25 people.
Oh, man.
And I had to let go my front of house manager and cut my kitchen team in half. And that was a 15-minute pre-meeting of like, there's no choice. It is, here's what it is, and this is what we have to do. Pivot. I think a lot of people didn't make those snap decisions, but you just start burning through capital. But it's like, all right, once it's shut down, now it's survival game. And we just switched over to make decisions quickly. And then closed down for 2 weeks and got to go set up and reopened as to go only.
Nice. And now I wasn't here. I was actually in Afghanistan during all this. I got to Afghanistan March 1st. So for me, COVID was, I was already on lockdown for a couple months. But when did the state open back up? When were you allowed to start having people come back in to the restaurant?
Oh, goodness. It was the end of the summer at some point. I could probably look at my point of sale. May, June, July. But somewhere between July and August, I want to say. Wow. I'm not sure. I think we got maybe 4 or 5 months of completely shut down to go only. And then it was 4 or 5 months of being able to do restaurant stuff. And then now we're back to shut down and to go
opening. Oh, really? They shut you guys down again?
Oh, yeah. So we are in the city of Syracuse, which is now an orange zone. So now, as an orange zone, you're allowed to do outdoor dining. And they created some grants for tents and heaters. But after some thought and discussion, we decided, I think by the time we get to December, January, no one's going to eat outside. That it's just not going to happen. I think that the outdoor dining thing is a little bit of a gimmick. And we see that now that a lot of places who invested in tents and outdoor heaters, the tents are empty, you know.
Nobody wants to eat outside in upstate New York in January.
Right. It just wasn't realistic. Yeah,
No. I don't care if you got a fireplace out there. I'm not going to eat in the middle of a damn snowstorm.
Right.
So
that it doesn't make sense. And if you're in an enclosed tent, how is that different than being indoors anyway?
It shows you how stupid the regulations are. I'm indoor, outdoor, indoor eating. Cool.
Right. Exactly. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the politicians are trying their best, but I mean, there's just no one really has the power to change anything in this. It just sucks. The big suck fest, you know, this.
You guys are all doing to go now. You're back to go's. You guys are allowed to sell alcohol though. Go. Mm-hmm. So is that coming out now? You guys got sixers? Is it growlers only? What's your to-go process look like?
Yeah, so we're doing food, growlers, cans. We can sell sixtils or half kegs at retail to people. While we still had some wholesale going, now that the it depends on what area everyone's in. Some places are still taking cans and bottles and kegs. It's obviously way more slowed down because the entire industry is slow, but it is what it is. That's one of the nice things about having had open the restaurant is if we were wholesale only right now, we'd almost be irrelevant. You know, there wouldn't be anything to do. There's no wholesale accounts. And I think 25% of our wholesale customers that we had beforehand, and we had maybe 150 wholesale accounts that we were selling kegs to. Mm-hmm. 25% are gone. They're like permanently closed. It's going to be a different landscape. Yeah. You know.
So when you all opened back up then during the end of summer, were you able to bring back that staff once the lockdown ceased? Were you able to, or did you continue to remain on a half staff, basically waiting to see if it was even worth? I'm sure there's some cost-based analysis that went into this decision, but what did you guys end up doing?
Well, I think when we first opened, we were overstaffed to begin with. And I think it was just pure chaos. We had a business partner we had brought in who was supposed to help with the restaurant. And it was just that did not work out. I was not supposed to be running a restaurant. I was supposed to be doing the brewing and doing CEO stuff. And finance and how do I grow the business? And then things went poorly with our new business partner and and then the whole world shut down. So in a sense, some of that kind of helped us out to just restart on some fronts. But during that period of time, we got to learn how to run the restaurant essentially on easy mode, where we're doing a very small amount of to-go, a very small amount of sales. And then that slowly scaled up. We kept in contact with our staff, our front of house team, anybody who wanted to come back, we brought them back in. But it was probably 20% of the staff because we were only doing 10% of the revenue.
Okay, so obviously we have to wait and see how things progress with the lockdowns and the code orange or yellow, whatever the hell they're doing now. But Hopefully things will open back up in the spring, next summer, and then you'll be able to go back to a full restaurant brewery. Your time is very, very limited and very important. So I would like to close this out over the next 10 minutes with basically, is there any advice that you could give to other operators that maybe have this entrepreneurship kind of bug in their head somewhere? You know, what advice would you give to people that want to get out of the unmanned community and want to pursue their dreams in the private sector?
Well, I would say the first step is get educated. The most dangerous, whether it be private sector or in the military, the most dangerous things to you are what you don't know that you don't know. Education. Go get a four-year degree in business administration. Go get a four-year degree in entrepreneurship or marketing. Learn about the private sector. I'd say that's number one. And then number two, once you're pursuing a business venture, focus on the consumer and do not fall in love with your own idea. It's one of the most slippery slopes of ideating a business venture is falling in love with your own idea. And idea is like a baby, you know, it's your baby, you love it. The question is, does anybody else love it? Because if they don't, you're not going to make money.
you might have an ugly baby, and
might have an ugly baby. Just keep that in mind. You need to, if it's your baby, maybe show your baby to as many people as possible, and try to get good feedback. When you do your market research, don't ask your mom; she's going to tell you it's great. Don't ask friends and family. You really want to ask strangers, and then also present it like it's not your idea. Hey, I'm doing market research for a friend. They have this idea. Can you tell me what you think? Just walk up to people on the street. You know, then you can get some honest feedback. You need to be as removed as possible so that you want to find out if you have an ugly baby as early as possible before you start investing more time and money into something, or verify that your baby's a great one. You know?
Yeah. I'd say if I had to summarize that, I'd say you guys need to go out and get degrees, specifically business related. If you're going to get a degree in some weird, I don't know, basket weaving or some other random bullshit that doesn't matter, it's not going to help you. Unless of course you're opening a basket weaving business, and then after the education is done, would you recommend a master's? Do you think that's absolutely necessary, or because that's another 2-3 years?
Well, I think it depends on what you want to do. A 4-year degree could be fine. Just it depends how much time you have, especially if you have 4 years left in the military, do a 4-year degree, you know, set up your timeline so that if you're planning on exiting, when you've accomplished all of your education goals or market research, you have all your ducks in a row. If you have the time, you just signed a 6-year contract, go through and get your master's, you know?
Yeah.
Do what you have the time to do. I mean, if you're separating next year and you have zero education, maybe
maybe start
your contract and take your time. Don't just jump into the pool willy-nilly.
Do you think that it, for people that are getting out or separating and wanting to go this route, do you think it would be advisable for them to get a business partner or to try to figure out what they want to do themselves first before they start getting ahead of themselves? I mean, when it comes to business partners, some people are all the way for it. Some people are for building a larger team. Some people want to do everything themselves and they can't relish that control or relinquish that control to other people. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the first thing is you want to make sure you don't want to just have random people as business partners. It needs to be a good fit. Mm-hmm. But There's a saying that equity is like shit. If you make a big pile of it, it just stinks. But if you spread it around, you can grow some beautiful stuff. You want partners, ideally, because partners are time. People who are going to be there and work for free to get things set up and also to create some dissent. Because if you're alone in a room and like you're just loving on your ugly baby, sometimes having a business partner there to say like, hey, let's look into this because it doesn't seem great. You need dissent and support and the hours in to make something work. Yeah, that's just my two cents on it. I think important things for business partnerships is someone has to have a majority. Never split a company 50-50 or 25-25, 25-25. It's not a good idea.
Let me ask you why. Why, if you
So,
have two, if you got two people and they both think they should be equal worth, why, how would you even have that discussion with somebody? Hey, I'm worth 60, you're worth 40, you're worth less than me. How does that discussion take place?
there is a lot of scholarly articles on how you split up a company. The like this is how much money I'm going to put in. This is what I'm going to do in the company. This is what I'm bringing to the table, and you have that discussion. Money's an easy one. Experience is one. Really, I'll just find some off compile a couple online resources and how like you would split it up. The main issue with splitting a company 50-50 is that if things go south, there will be no way to fix it. There's just no one has the decision-making authority. You're going to have to liquidate the company in order to for everybody to get their stuff out. If someone has 51%, at least that person can make decisions and change things.
Or maybe find another partner to
Find
offset
another partner, do a
that.
buyout. But I definitely would not recommend going straight up 50-50 into business with anyone.
No, that's good. That's
Like
good.
too many horror stories.
Oh, that's good. I thought that was an interesting point. Especially when you have two people that want to work on something together. And most
Right.
people do think, well, 50-50 would be fair. But maybe that isn't the best decision. And like you said, money could be one of the things you separate yourselves by or experience. So, and I think that if somebody knows that they put in a little bit less experience or money, that they'd probably be happy settling for a little bit less of that ownership. So.
Yeah, and the other thing is for different benefits, like if you're separating and you're like a disabled veteran or a minority or a woman, like someone has to have 51% in order to benefit from any of the advantages that would come from that.
Yep, that's a good point. Awesome. Well, Logan, I know that you got some stuff to do. I know it's a busy time for you right now in this COVID survival mode. So, I just want to thank you for being on the show and giving your insight into entrepreneurship and leaving the young man community and pursuing your goals. And I love your restaurant. I love the stuff that you brew down there. And I guess I need to go get some growlers. You all are open on Wednesdays through Sunday?
Yep, Wednesday through Sunday. The hours vary right now, so check us out online, anythingwithbeer.com.
Okay.
On Google, we update our hours on Anything with Beer's Facebook page, Google page. And thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, I've noticed that recently. A lot of businesses aren't updating their Google hours, and I'll drive 20 minutes to a place and it's closed, and it really pisses me off. So the fact that you guys are updating your hours across your social medias and across the internet is great. So for anyone listening, if you're in the central New York area or Syracuse specifically, check out anythingbutbeer.com. I'm sure you guys got some cool merch on there too. So yeah, everybody listening, check it out. And Logan, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and sign off now. All right.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, man. It's Chris Kessler signing off, everybody. Cheers.
Cheers.